Today's conversation, and it really was a conversation more than an interview, and it's one of my favorites so far, is with Prem Krishnamurthy. Prem is a designer, author, and educator. His multifaceted work explores the role of art as an agent of transformation at an individual, collective, and structural level. This manifests itself in books, exhibitions, images, performances, publications, systems, talks, texts, and workshops. That's his official bio, the first paragraph of his official bio from his website. And I think it only begins to open up the idea generation and thoughtfulness of his practice that really does cross disciplines and manifests itself in many different arenas. I've known of his work for probably about a decade and a half from when I first met him in New York, and have just always found it to be so regenerative, so thoughtful, and so completely fresh. And the second I try to pin it down, it seems as though it slips away. And that's one of my favorite qualities in any thinker or artist. So it was a real pleasure to speak with him today. And one of the first things I asked him was to have him describe his practice, because I wanted to hear from him how he thinks of his work and its location in the wider creative field. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Here we go. Honestly, one of the reasons I even started doing this podcast was so that I could talk to people that I don't talk to enough, and I put you very high on that list. And it's just a real pleasure to catch up today. So thank you.
Of course. For me, it's also, I feel like sometimes these kind of long-term dialogues get totally lost. It is one of the main advantages of our Zoomocene kind of post-pandemic world that we can actually connect more easily.
I totally agree with you. And one thing that I do at the beginning of every recording is I take a portrait of my screen of you. And so if you would just humor me to do that briefly, let me just grab a portrait.
Sounds good.
Your beard looks amazing, by the way.
Thanks. I've been, you know, I've really been working hard at it. I've been just letting it grow. I can never get anything on the top anymore, so I may as well grow hair where I can.
Could you tell listeners a little bit about how you locate yourself in the larger creative world, in the larger design and art ecology? What is your self-description?
It's a great question. And the truth is it constantly changes. I feel like I am, by constitution and by practice, I've been professionally peripatetic for the last many decades. But at the moment, I call myself a designer, author, and educator, which seems to capture a lot of things, depending on how expanded of a definition you have. I mean, I studied art originally. I studied art and graphic design and was always focused as well on performance as part of that practice. And I came to design from a very conceptual place. But when I moved to New York over 20 years ago, I began to work first as a graphic designer and started my first graphic design studio, Project Projects. And while I was running Project Projects, I also became involved in Paper Monument, which was a publication started by Roger White and Dusko Petrovic, but that I became an editor and designer of too. And then I started a gallery called P! Exclamation and worked. It was an experimental gallery that also had a really strong interest in new curatorial models. And since then, I think my work has expanded into larger curatorial endeavors, but also writing and publishing in experimental formats. And I think at the same time, running in parallel has been my teaching. I've always seen what I do as a kind of teaching and learning. So I'm interested in that.
I have to ask everyone the first time they're on the show one of my favorite questions. What is your earliest memory of art?
It's a hard question to answer my absolute earliest memory, but I know a couple of really significant ones for me. One thing is that my family didn't have a strong relationship to art. My parents were immigrants from India who came to the US in the 1960s. And so we might go to museums sometimes, but it was not in a way that was, you know, I didn't feel like that was something that was part of our life growing up in a major way. I first came to art from fiction and literature, mostly science fiction and fantasy books, but it was really coming to art from writing and thinking about narratives. It's definitely not my first experience of art or my first memory of art, but I do remember in my teens, in my late teens, visiting MoMA and seeing a Malevich black square there. And it blew me away. I said to myself, my Lord, I didn't realize you could make that and call that art. So it blew open what I thought art was.
I hear you on that. And I appreciate that answer in light of what you were describing as the way that you see your practice now. You know, I almost feel like, and it's so fascinating to think about you coming to art through fiction and through narrative, because in some ways I feel like your art is, it's so much more about the idea behind something. It's almost this, the concepts to me seem as though they come to you so clearly as the seed for sort of what you produce. And I get the sense that for you, in the same way that the black square represented this kind of radical way of thinking about what art could even be, I almost see you expanding that into art can be running a gallery as much as it can be writing, as much as it can be teaching. And that kind of educational pedagogic standpoint feels very clear and very much a through line through your work, at least as I observe it. And I wonder if that feels accurate to you. Is it really about the ideas as the primary mover in your practice?
Well, I think I could agree with that if we expanded the idea of what an idea is, because I don't think an idea is an abstract thing. I think an idea is something that's material. It takes a shape. It takes a form. It encounters other people. It encounters situations. And so for me, it's as much about some sort of conceptual basis as it is the actual material format that it inhabits. That's where my training and my experience and my love of design comes in, because I think that you need both, but I also don't see them. Actually, it's not both, because they're not separable.
Right.
You know, however an idea is expressed, whether it's in language, whether it's in a diagram, or whether it's in a large, you know, multi-format performance, all of those things are the way that that idea manifests itself.
Yeah. I completely appreciate what you're saying there. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit just to help listeners get a better understanding of the trajectory of your practice. Could you talk a little bit about where you have lived over the years? You spent quite a bit of time in Berlin, if I understand correctly. I met you in New York. How does place inform that kind of idea and objectness that you bring together?
I think place is intrinsically, it's like just the context of people and architecture. It has different affordances. So for me, I mean, I first moved to Berlin first in the 1990s to study abroad, and then I came back there to work and came back with a fellowship and then ended up starting my design career there. And I think if I hadn't been in Berlin in that moment, if I hadn't felt the openness, the kind of the sense that anything was possible, I feel like my trajectory might have been very different. I have a lot of colleagues from my studies who moved directly to New York and immediately were confronted by the harsh economic realities of New York and the sense that in New York, you're always defined by what you do. Whereas in Berlin, in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was almost a faux pas to ask somebody at a party, what do you do? Because to limit somebody just to that professional work was seen as some sort of reduction mm-hmm. of their basic humanity. And so I think that having that ability to be more fluid was really useful. And at other points in time, I remember around 2009, 2010, 2011, I was working a lot in Istanbul because of this institution there called SALT. I probably went to Istanbul maybe 15, maybe more times in the course of 2 or 3 years. And that was also eye-opening for me because I realized that everybody who was working as an artist, or not everybody, but many people working as artists, they also had practices as designers. They also had practices as writers, as teachers. And it was a much more expanded notion of an artistic creative practice than one that was one-dimensional. And I think that's, for me, the main thing. People are multidimensional. And somehow, particularly in New York, sometimes we forget that.
I appreciate you saying that. I think that's just as true now as it ever was, if not more so. I feel like there's so many directions to take that. And I think already people are probably getting a sense of the kind of expansiveness of thought and making that you bring to your practice. I don't think we're terribly separated by age. And, you know, we are of a generation that has seen digital life, the network of connection internationally, nationally, and so forth, become such an integral part of all of the work that we do. Could you talk a little bit about how your work relates to the internet, how it has shifted the way that you practice? It's funny. I mean, I don't really know you as as an internet artist per se, or, you know, you don't necessarily limit yourself to that kind of focus, but I do think of you as a very highly engaged digital practitioner. And could you talk a little bit about maybe how having lived through those shifts have impacted your practice, and, you know, and what are you seeing now in terms of potential?
I think I first designed a website in the late 1990s, sometime around then, and had to learn on my own how to code in HTML and JavaScript and figure out how to clunk things together. But I mean, my mother was a software developer and worked in robotics in the 80s. And so technology was something that was always there for me. Even if I didn't pursue that as my main professional path, I was never scared of technology. It was never a thing that I tried to avoid. Or, you know, I've seen already at least 3 different modes of graphic production and reproduction, from paste up and stat cameras in the early 90s to the ways that we're producing graphics now. But it's true that I don't think of myself, while my work is really about digital experiences, as well as how people read, how people gather, how people experience their bodies in space, I've never personally been as interested in the bleeding edge of technology as I am in formats that are actually, might seem commonplace or mundane, but can be tweaked. For example, for many years, I was really interested in the very basic and ubiquitous format of the PDF, because even though it seems it's just something we take for granted, there's something deeper in the fact that, first of all, it can collapse presentation and communication narrative into a single form. Second, it lives on a computer. It's a thing that becomes a distributed object instead of being something that is out there that you're accessing. And it is a thing that becomes in that way, it can be both an object and be something that's changing. I mean, there's this great quote by Stanley Eveling, who's a theater director, which is, a thing is just a slow event. I think that that for me captures a lot of the promise of the digital world and why I think of that as being intrinsically part of my work. And particularly during the pandemic, I think when a lot of people were really shy about Zoom and the ways that of communication that cropped up, I kind of leaned into that. I said, well, if this is the way that we're gathering, then I need to figure out how to make this format something that's truly generative, because community and the way that different people come together is the core of everything I do. And so now's the time to learn some new tools.
Yeah, I mean, you worked with us at iBeam at the onset of the pandemic with the Rapid Response for a Better Digital Future project. And for us, that was such a learning experience where we took that same approach of, okay, things are shifting wildly and rapidly. How do we actually lean into the curve and start to learn how to better build community while working online? And it has been absolutely fascinating to sort of see that experiment pay off, in the sense that, and I would love to get your take on this, but it feels like there's a way that you can actually build meaningful community among people online. And it's different, but it's deep, and it's not necessarily transitory, or it's not as transactional as it might, you know, as one might have expected. You know, with our fellows, they have come together and collaborated and commiserated and critiqued each other's work. And actually, sometimes some of the fellows will actually just leave Zoom on while they're working in their studios in different parts of the world without even speaking, just so that they can have that sense of a community with another person. And I find that so fascinating. And it's not the same as being in person, but it has a lot of the same meaningful outcomes, I think, in the way that people can relate to each other. And that's kind of beautiful to see. And I wonder, you know, do you feel like we're at the precipice of even doing a better job, or even learning new ways of being together digitally that could be more positive? Because I actually, that's a part of this whole shift that I feel optimistic about, actually, is that ability to come together. And I think there's a lot more that we could explore in that way.
I'm totally with you. I also am optimistic about it. I understand from the perspective of, say, educators who suddenly were confronted in March 2020 with whole groups of students and trying to adjust to a new mode of teaching. I understand their, you know, frustration or the challenges of that. But I also do think what's become clear here in 2023 and going forward is it's always going to be a hybrid world. We're going to have some interactions in person. We're going to have some interactions online synchronously. We're going to have some interactions asynchronously online in one form or another. I mean, to me, reading itself is also an asynchronous communication. It's just the time frame of it is really, you know, it's much further on the spectrum of asynchronicity. But yeah, I think that what I found in those early months and years of, you know, of the Zoomocene in 2020, 2021 was that if you resort to the defaults of some of these modes of communication like Zoom, then it sometimes can be cold and sterile and non-personal, but it's when you start to misuse it or push how it's supposed to be employed that it gets interesting. For example, you know, the basic algorithms of Zoom want to cancel noise and make only one speaker dominant, because it's meant for a meeting where, in the mode of the programmers and designers, one person's voice is most important. But sometimes in groups of people, I have them turn on the original sound for musicians so that we can hear the background noise in other people's spaces. so that we can listen to each other, so multiple people can speak at once, so we can do karaoke online, all of these things that somehow change what your interaction with other people is. But for me, what's really important, what it's made really clear, is that, you know, after spending, say, March 2020 through fall of 2020, working really hard to see how you could organize an experience on Zoom that would feel really meaningful and personal and generative, but also creative, I then went to one of my first like lecture talks that I'd been to. And it was the experience of having three artists, each of whom spoke for 45 or 50 minutes without a pause. Then there were 5 minutes of questions. There were no bio breaks, mm-hmm. and we were all in lines in a big auditorium. And I thought to myself, this is old technology. Like, right. This mode of interacting with people is old technology. And so I feel like we now need to learn the things that came up through Zoom and interacting in a hybrid way and bring them back into our everyday interactions in real life to make those richer.
Yes, totally. And that is one of the things I actually have some concern about is, you know, can we actually remember these things that we learned in those early days, and really begin to introduce those into our lived experience in our bodies? Sarah Wookie, a researcher that I spoke to recently in London, you know, she thinks a lot about that as well. And she also made the point that even the way that people interacted bodily during the pandemic, that there was value to considering one's distance from another person, and that there are these elements that, while of course, you know, came under, you know, arose out of duress in many ways, but there are like really positive things that we can keep from that time and bring that into the present and now intentionally build that into the future. And I think that's such an interesting approach. And maybe this is a good segue to hear you talk a little bit about the work that you did online during the pandemic. I remember you being very active. I believe you were leaning into more of the educational component of your work in some ways, if I'm not mistaken. You were convening in extraordinarily interesting ways people from all over the world around particular topics. And could you talk a little bit about your practice, particularly over the last, you know, 2.5 years, 3 years, and how you responded to some of the shifts that you've already started pointing to?
March 2020 was obviously a turning point or an important punctuation mark for a lot of people. But for me, it really started to clarify what I'd been doing for the last 20 or 25 years. I think I realized in those early months of the pandemic and the first lockdown that the work I'd been doing in starting a graphic design studio and starting a gallery and helping to found a publication magazine and even curating these large-scale triennials and biennials was about bringing different people together into a certain space. And in the pandemic, in those early days, a couple of things happened. One was this project called Home Cooking that the artist Asad Raza kind of really initiated, but then he invited all of these other people, including me, to come in and help program this really dynamic, performative online space. And that out of that grew the project that was called Present! Exclamation mark, which was a weekly gathering on Zoom every Sunday for several months, and then it had almost like different seasons. And Present was really a experimental format that was about connecting. I mean, it had aspects of a talk show, it had aspects of a seminar, of a reading group, but there would also be embodied activities, sometimes meditation, sometimes small groups, and almost always dancing and karaoke. So it was a way to kind of test out the limits of the medium itself while also creating something generative and connecting different people who might otherwise feel the isolation of the pandemic really strongly. And then later that fall, during the election of 2020, together with the artist Kalia Mallory, who's now the director of the Luminary in St. Louis, we organized a project called The Human Way that was essentially a distributed reading group where 64 people who all applied to it did The Artist's Way, the self-help book by Julia Cameron, for 12 weeks together. And we simply assembled them randomly into small groups based on their time zone and asked them to meet regularly and do the book together. And then we checked in with them periodically. It was a kind of a social experiment to see how that might work. And what's really encouraging is I was just in Portland a couple of months ago, and some of the people who were in that project told me that they're still meeting with their groups, that there are still connections 3 years. I know. And that was the idea. It was like, can we take people who have no knowledge of each other and create the proper container that might help them to connect?
I hear you. And that's where it gets so interesting, is when that hybrid relation starts to grow out of these online encounters. I mean, we have fellows that after the fellowship shared stories of collaborating on projects in person when they happen to be in the same city at the same time. And it's so clear to me that a both and approach is kind of the only way to go forward in this realm. And hearing you talk about that, it almost makes me nostalgic for some of the energy that people were putting into online gatherings and convenings in those early days. I wonder where that's going to go. And how we're going to keep learning from this, and what this next stage of hybrid encounters could look like.
You're right that one thing that always happens is you have some sort of new technological or social change or crisis. It changes how people act and how they act in the world, and then it kind of renormalizes itself, and then we forget a lot of the things we've learned, or they get incorporated into the practices we have. I mean, I guess for me, an interesting recent example was that together with Asad Raza, who again, you know, was really the initiator, the catalyst for home cooking, he and I were co-artistic directors of this gathering, this experimental symposium in Washington, D.C., organized by Washington Project for the Arts. And it's a project that started in its conceptual phase in 2021, and we focused it around the question of how can we gather now. And I think that, actually one of the things that happened is we learned in an implicit way from what happened in the pandemic. Let's say even on an organizational level, first of all, the entire organization of the thing was done purely on Zoom. We never met any of the people involved on the team until March of 2023. And of course, it turned out that they were all like a little taller or a little shorter than we expected. That's what seems to happen. But otherwise, there was a deep sense of connection because we had been working on this together for so long. So, and I feel like that just wouldn't have been possible in another form. If we had been limited to face-to-face encounters, it couldn't have evolved so fluidly over such a long period with so many collaborators. I also realize as I'm saying that this is also, it's also nothing new. It's just gotten amped up. When I first started working in Istanbul, we designed several books with this institution, these two institutions in Istanbul that became SALT, before we ever went there physically. Like we first went there when the books were printed and when there was a launch, maybe a year after we began the projects. And so, you know, it was Skype back then instead of Zoom, and it had different formats, but, you know, people have been faxing things to each other for however long, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's just it's not as new as people think it is.
That is such a good point. And I really appreciate you bringing that. Because it's so interesting because I'm right there with you. These technologies, they've been around for a while. Like this is not something that just kind of appeared out of the blue. But there's just something about the kind of social momentum around them that I guess is the thing that causes them to just break through and reach this kind of, you know, tipping point or something where they, you know, just become part of our lives. And one of the first projects that I saw you take on, I believe after shortly after things were starting to get back to normal, was the Front International, the Cleveland Triennial for Contemporary Art. And could you talk a little bit about that experience and kind of thinking around this sort of physical space versus digital experience and the role that place plays in the kind of work that you do? What did you find in Cleveland, and what did you what was that project?
Well, Front started before the pandemic. It started really in the second half of 2018 for me, and then in 2019 I was named co-artistic director together with Tina Kukelski, who then later during the pandemic had to step down because of family, you know, pressures and childcare and all of these things during the pandemic. But we started it before the pandemic. And, you know, what was interesting is in 2019, we would visit Cleveland periodically. We'd visit like every month or month and a half or two in order to do some research on the ground, meet people, meet artists, think about what Cleveland was like. And then when the pandemic hit, I mean, and I should actually mention, we then announced in January of 2020 that our show would be called Oh Gods of Dust and Rainbows, from a line from a Langston Hughes poem, and that the show would be focused on art as an agent of transformation, a mode of healing, and a therapeutic process. And that was in January of 2020. And then 2 months later, everything shifted. And suddenly, like, the idea of art as a mode of healing seemed even more relevant. But I think that you're right that, you know, in many ways, I then was in Berlin for 18, 19 months because of the lockdown and because of vaccines taking longer here. And during that time, everything happened remotely. And then it was finally in summer of 2021 that I was able to come back to Cleveland and really start to spend more time there. I think that one of the things about triennials and biennials that's interesting is that for a long time, I mean, I've worked as a designer. We've worked as designers on probably a dozen or more biennials or triennials over the years. And even though they're always trying to be really rooted in a place or oftentimes want to be, the practicalities of curating, of designing a triennial often mean that people kind of fly in and out. That's the nature of them. I know, and when, you know, when Front actually, when we opened the show in July of 2022, I had been saying for months, I said, well, you know, I wish that I could really be here for the run of the show, because that's when people are going to encounter these artworks and these experiences. And I want to be there for that. I mean, that to me is what is exciting about exhibitions. They're a meeting point for people and objects and ideas. And it's a really dynamic space. And as the show opening got closer and closer, I suddenly realized, like, well, maybe I could do that. Maybe I could come and spend a lot more time in Cleveland in order to see how it lands and really be part of that. So as it turned out, I ended up spending a lot of the run of the show from July to October of 2022 in Cleveland or around Cleveland. And for me, it was an incredibly rich experience to open up the show in different ways. And that's what then made me start to think about how art is happening on the ground in other parts of the U.S.
Yeah, I appreciate that so much. And that sort of brings me to this sort of wild question, I suppose I'm just going to ask. Given your experiences internationally, nationally, do you understand what America is? Did you understand what America is better after that experience?
I mean, I understand that there is no America.
Yeah.
I mean, I think America, I think I knew this to some extent 25 years ago, the first or second time that I drove through the US and realized, I mean, America is there's no one idea. It's like calling, it's like I never talk about community anymore. I think it's always about communities.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's a challenge. I mean, I think part of my travels through the US this winter and spring to different art schools and different, you know, organizations and cities and places has been to just try and understand the multiplicity of the country, to try to dig in a little bit into this idea that there's so many different parts. But it, on another level, it shouldn't surprise me, because it's clear that, for example, an individual is already many parts. I mean, right. Neuroscientifically speaking, psychologically speaking, there are all of these frameworks for the fact that the self is a collection of parts. And then you have a group, and a group itself is then multiple people, all of whom have their own parts. And then when you get to the level of a society or a country, that's, you know, one more level of fractal complexity. But I think that sometimes, I mean, my basic read of thinking about a lot of the divisions and the crisis of community in the US is that, you know, we, in the same way that what we were talking about with professional definitions, it's that exacerbated and blown up, because when we meet somebody, we want to put them into a single category. We want to understand them as one thing. And that's not only professionally, but it's also in political, religious belief. We say, you are an X. And because you are an X, you're not a Y. Whereas actually those things, this kind of duality or this sense of division, it's like all of those things can be true at once. People are very complex. Groups are complex. Societies are very complex.
I appreciate that so much. And it's just such a reminder that there is a heterogeneity in the individual and the group and the national experience that I feel like it's just so under-recognized sometimes. And it's really fascinating to just see how that fits into your larger practice in kind of exploding those definitions. I feel like that's a whole nother podcast to go down that road about America too much, but it's quite dispiriting sometimes to just see how narrow we want to define other people in this country. And it sounds like what you're doing is actively resisting that narrowness.
Absolutely. And that's in the broader political arena, but I also think on the level of artistic practice, I'm trying to think about juxtaposition. I mean, this is one of the things I often try to think about and practice is, you know, I think that there's been a myth for a very long time, maybe 500 years plus or minus, that the artist is this singular, yeah, genius, typically male, yeah, individual. When anybody who practices art knows that there might be parts of that are true. You might actually spend a half hour or an hour or 2 hours a day drawing or writing or doing something individually, but much of the rest of the time is spent with other people, either in collaborative situations with people who are assisting, helping, who are partners in things. And I feel like at the same time, particularly in design, but also in art, there's been this idea that an artwork or has to have like a single expression instead of being able to be multiple. It doesn't have to be a single thing. And I work that often into my practice by, on just the basic level of trying to involve different people who have very different viewpoints than me. For example, when I was invited first to be artistic director of this symposium in Washington, D.C., my first move was to invite Assad as co-artistic director, because I knew that even though we're friends and have some similarities, we have very different approaches to thinking about time and space and people. Then we two, together with WPA, invited, with Washington Project for the Arts, invited a whole group of artist organizers, some of whom were based in DC and the region, some of whom were working internationally. And then each of those people invited their own people to the symposium. So we ended up with a kind of gathering of gatherings. And it offered, I mean, something that became really clear to me there was that you can actually make something that's more meaningful to different people through that approach. For example, as I already said, I'm not the biggest fan of the frontal lecture format. That's never been the mode from which I feel like I get the most. But, you know, there were lots of people at the symposium who really appreciated that. And when we did a kind of retrospective debrief with the folks who were there at the end and said, what worked and what didn't work, what would you change? What I thought was fascinating was that there would be people who said, I hated the lectures. Like, this is not good. We should have more of these collaborative or, you know, experiential or gustatory experiences. And then there were other people who said, I loved the lectures. They were great. Because, I mean, I've been listening to this audiobook of Susan Cain's Quiet from a bunch of years ago. It's a book on introversion and how the power of introverts in a world that prizes extroversion. And it's been fascinating for me because it's made it even clearer how, whether it's an experimental symposium or an online gathering or even a work of design or a bounded installation or artwork, by offering different modes and different entry points and different ways to engage with it, different formats rather than a single format, I mean, this juxtaposition can actually make a thing much richer. Yeah. And it reflects the world that we live in a very different way.
Right. And the thing that I'm just enjoying so much about the way you're talking about this is that I get the sense it's juxtaposition, but it's not for the purpose of resolution. I don't feel like you're, and I find that to just be so necessary to the way that we kind of think of the world, is that we don't have to resolve the juxtapositions. We don't have to resolve the difference.
Conflict is an essential part of life.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that as a culture, particularly in America, I think this is actually different in some other places, we are so uncomfortable with conflict. We run away from it, as opposed to being able to sit with difference and sit with the discomfort and actually just acknowledge it and accept it, learn from it. And that's, to me, yes, I think that when you, I often think about Vandana Shiva, the Indian biodiversity activist, who wrote Monocultures of the Mind in the 1990s. And she has this phrase that I love. She talks about the production of uniformity. What she means is that there's no more than human context or ecosystem that is uniform. It's actually about diversity. It's about difference. It's about competition and also how a system is sustainable through that constant cycling. And it's this kind of manufactured, even kind of modern idea that you can have a thing that's uniform. That's the lie.
That's so well said and so refreshing. And I think we need more of that. We need more people saying exactly what you're saying and just an acceptance that is what is behind sustainability, is that difference and that juxtaposition. And without it, you don't have sustainability. And I think that's absolutely correct. And, you know, I guess sort of shifting a little bit into a slightly different topic, I'd like to talk a little bit about your writing itself. You came to your practice from writing, and you still write. I believe most recently On Letters was the most recent book that you've written. Could you tell us about that? What was it? What drove the practice? And what were you aiming for in the kind of writing that you brought to this?
Well, On Letters started, its kind of long backstory is, it starts with a talk that I gave at DIA Beacon in 2015. And you know, at the time they'd asked me to do one of their artists on artists talks, and I chose On Kawara because I used to deeply dislike On Kawara's work. I mean, 20 or 25 years ago when I first encountered it, I found it, you know, as a graphic designer by training, I had this really simplistic dismissal of it. I said, oh, it's just typeset in a bad font. And, you know, it's just so simple. Yeah. And, you know, it's just like, it's so easy. Anybody could just typeset a date. And of course, I was completely wrong about it. Of course, I completely misunderstood it because I thought it was typography when in fact it's not. It's all handmade and it changes over time. It's not consistent. And that's the whole point. That's why I came to realize it's lettering, not typography. But I mean, I took the opportunity with that talk to go deeper on it precisely because it was a thing that had irritated me. And I mean, speaking of conflict and juxtaposition, sometimes it's going deep into the things that slow you down or that confuse you that's most important. I mean, I remember reading in Marcia Tucker's posthumous biography, A Short Life of Trouble, she talks about that with Bruce Nauman's work and how she hated it the first time she saw it. So then she kept going back to his studio to understand why she hated it and eventually gave him his first one-person show in a museum. But yeah, so I gave this talk on Kawara. And then in 2020, again, David Knowles, who's a designer and publisher, he knew about that talk and asked me, hey, would you turn it into a book? And I said, yes. But of course, I don't tend to make things easy for myself. So instead of turning the talk into a book, I decided to write an entirely new book. That took the form of letters written to On Kawara, who, since he passed away in 2014 or 15, you know, he will never read ostensibly. Well, maybe he will somewhere up there. But what came out of that process and, you know, my intention with this book was to, again, to do something that is not quite as straightforward as it seems. I mean, it started from the idea, or the invitation was to write a book about On Kawara from the perspective of design and thinking about the lettering. And I decided to kind of open that up in multiple dimensions. First of all, in the kind of narrative level, it starts from that point and from my misunderstanding, but then really goes into artistic practice in general and, you know, my own education, questions of abstraction and race and numbering systems and more. But then also on how the level of how it's written, I tried to use this epistolary format to add a little more friction into it, to make it something unusual, but to also allow it to be more personal. But each of these letters is also quite different from each other. So it almost becomes a little bit of a juxtaposition because, I mean, I wrote them, they started the process as this daily writing where I would write a letter every day to him when I woke up. So I think like, I mean, and my goal in a way is to make something that might be useful for people coming at it from the perspective of design, but also for people coming at it from conceptual art, and also for people who know nothing about any of those things.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. And I think it's fascinating to think of it working on those multiple levels simultaneously. And that's not easy to pull off. So congratulations on that. I mean, I think it's a very exciting approach. And it's just great to see you writing. What are you working on now? And what's next for you?
The last several months have seen, you know, have basically given me the opportunity to really start to prototype what I call the Department of Transformation. This is something that has also a backstory and a longer history. Around 2016, 2017, and the election in the US, I started to think much more actively about the role of pedagogy mm-hmm. and the role of art education and design education in encouraging more collaborative modes of working and how you could move away from kind of top-down models and find more kind of self-organizing or decentralized structures for both learning and practice. And actually, it goes back even further in my experiences working in studios and with artists and other things. But somehow last year after Front, I mean, this really came together as the idea of the Department of Transformation, which is me and other people I'm in dialogue with. And it's a way of both sharing and teaching and learning art that is more focused on collaboration and how art can be transformative at the individual, collective, and structural levels. So I spent this spring on a kind of prototype teaching tour where I went to about 10 different places in the US and went to art schools, design schools, museums, nonprofits. I was also at an agricultural research center, which was fascinating.
Wow.
It was totally fascinating. And trying to share these frameworks for art as an agent of transformation, but then also really specific collaborative tools, like interpersonal protocols. Because I think that sometimes we think that, you know, you're either good at working with others or you're not. You're either good at listening or you're not. You're either good at conflict or you're not. Whereas in fact, these are things we practice and learn. And so that was a kind of first try at that, this 2-month teaching tour. And it was really generative. It was super challenging at times and really intense, but also quite amazing. And the feedback that came back, and people are still writing me to say how they're trying to adapt and use some of the things that they learned, which is what I want. I want people to kind of take it and make it their own. So right now I'm trying to, it's the early phases, but I'm starting to work on a new book, which will take many aspects of this. Again, like in the model of hybridity or juxtaposition, I'm thinking of it as a mix of a kind of framework around art, a ways of thinking about art in the decades to come that moves away from this very individualistic model but also case studies of specific, you know, artist and designer practices that I think are really relevant, but also combined with a methodological part of it, actual kind of tools and things that people can use. Because ultimately, I don't know, I'm a real sucker for things that have a use value in whatever form.
And I'm glad you are. You know, and especially given the sort of less than superb state that many art schools are finding themselves in. I mean, I grew up in the southern United States myself, near Memphis, Tennessee. And while I never attended, you know, I had so many friends that were at the Memphis College of Art, and to have a, you know, an art school like that in an area in that part of the country was such a valuable resource to, you know, even indirectly and kind of second and third tier influence in the communities around it. So to have these kinds of very practical learning methodologies that people can plug into in the absence of some of those schools, I think is necessary, and it's very exciting to think about. So as we sort of close down here, where can people learn more about your work? What are the best places to find you online? How do people dig into your practice?
Because of the many different things I do, I feel like my work is just experienced often, hopefully somewhat anonymously in lots of different contexts. I often think there are parts of myself just dispersed through the world, like the books that I've designed and other things. But at the moment, the main kind of output that I think people can see is a newsletter that comes out on Substack from the Department of Transformation. It's something that I send out pretty, you know, irregularly, maybe once a month or two or three, but I try to make it as useful as possible. I really think of it as a space to share, you know, things, materials that I'm thinking about, reading, listening to, tools that people might adapt into their practices, the feedback that's come back from other people. So I think of it, again, like in the sense of a piece of writing being an asynchronous dialogue. It's much more a conversation than it is a broadcast.
It's so great to talk to you today, Prem, and I appreciate your time. I appreciate your just generosity of thought, and for taking the time to share what you're working on and thinking about. And it's good to see you.
Great to see you too. Thank you for the questions. And thank you for such an inspiring conversation. It's giving me new things to think about.
Good, good. My job is done. Until next time, thanks for joining me at Informer, and I hope that you'll join us again.